Hello and welcome to Science World. Scientists think that one of the best ways to help rid the world of malaria is to eliminate most of the female mosquitoes. So they've come up with a way to produce mostly male mosquito offspring. We'll hear about a Washington, D.C. area community science club that is providing a special place for people, especially kids, to work on science projects and hobbies. And on today's one-on-one segment, we talk with the author of a new book about the 1815 eruption of Indonesia's Mount Tambora, one of the most explosive volcanic eruptions of the last several thousand years. These stories and more are coming your way on VOA Science Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. A new way to fight malaria aims to eliminate the female mosquitoes that spread the deadly disease. Scientists have developed mosquitoes that produce almost exclusively male offspring. Steve Barragona reports.
There are plenty of good reasons to want to get rid of mosquitoes, says Peter Hotez, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine.
Well, mosquitoes have been labeled as the most virulent-killing animal in the world. More people die of mosquito-transmitted infections than they do almost any other type of illness.
Spraying insecticides is one of the most effective ways to control mosquitoes, but spraying comes with downsides. It can kill bees and other good insects and cause environmental damage. And mosquitoes eventually develop resistance to the pesticides.
We found a way. We found like an Achilles heel of these mosquitoes.
Imperial College London researcher Nikolai Wienbichler says the mosquito's Achilles heel is the 400 copies of a particular gene on the X chromosome. That's the chromosome that carries the traits making the insects female. Females are the ones that bite, and they are the ones that produce more mosquitoes. Using genetic engineering, Wienbichler and his colleagues introduced a protein from a creature called a slime mold that cuts each copy of that mosquito gene in one specific place. The slime mold enzyme is designed to turn on when the mosquitoes make sperm, slicing the X chromosome in 400 places.
You can imagine that that's pretty bad for a chromosome, right? So it gets destroyed. It cannot be passed on to the next generation.
That leaves only male offspring. And those offspring also would produce only male offspring. Eventually, the population would crash. And Wienbichler says it would be eliminated without harming anything else.
If you compare what we are doing to, for example, insecticides, which target any insect species out there, our method is really like very specific. So there may be hundreds of mosquito species in the environment, but our method really only would target that one.
They published the research in the journal Nature Communications. They have more tests to do to make sure the method is safe and effective.
It's an interesting finding, an exciting finding. It's still at very early stage.
Baylor's Peter Hotez was not involved in the research, but he says it will take more than just designer mosquitoes to beat malaria. New drugs and vaccines will be needed, along with bed nets and clearing their breeding grounds with good old-fashioned puddle draining. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
A Washington, D.C. area couple has turned an empty store into a space for people, especially kids, to work on science projects and hobbies. In this report by Faiza El-Masri, Faith Lapidus tells us about this community science club.
From the outside, Club 125, named for its street address, looks like any other store in a shopping area. From inside, it is a science lab with dozens of computers, laptops, wires, light bulbs, screws, and more.
Our three core areas are robotics, microelectronics, and computer science.
George Boyce and his wife, Eva Fallon, who both work in internet technology, founded the club.
It gives us an opportunity to introduce kids and their families and adults to science and technology. And it gives people an opportunity to work hands-on and learn some new stuff that they might not be able to learn in school, or as adults they don't have an opportunity to work with because they don't have the right resources.
School children come here with their teachers or parents.
I like science, but I like making robots better.
11-year-old Dinah Cohen is a homeschool student. With her father's help, she used the resources at Club 125 to make a robot in the shape of an elephant.
We wanted to make it move. I'd like to make the elephant work better.
Her mother and teacher, Leah Cohen, says visiting Club 125 is a great learning opportunity.
She comes here and has to solve a problem, with her Lego robotics. Coming here is really great because it's a really diverse group of people. So Dinah learns from kids who are younger than herself, and she learns how to work with kids that are older than herself. And she also works with the wide variety of adults that are in here too.
That's exactly what George Boyce dreamed the creative space would provide.
We're actually open more hours and different hours from the library, so we're able to provide access to resources like our computer network and our laptop so that the kids can come in.
Boyce and Fallon transformed a dry cleaning store into the community club.
It's very hands-on, and it's also very self-directed.
Volunteers like Wendy Cooler help run the club.
The space serves as something of a community living room. It's like an extension of my home. You know, it continues to challenge us to have better and more meaningful relationships with each other, to share skills and share food and share our lives with each other and help to raise each other's children.
Club 125, she says, defines what a community is and, in the process, promotes experimentation and curiosity. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
German researchers have developed a new 3D X-ray machine that can look inside living insects for a detailed picture of how they move as they move. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us about it in this report by George Butich.
Scientists try to create robots that imitate insects' movements as their bodies are perfectly adapted to their natural habitats. But with more than a million known species and dozens of habitats, there's still a lot to learn about insect mechanics. Thomas van de Kamp, a biologist at Germany's Karlsruhe Institute of Technology, says a new X-ray machine will help scientists see precisely how insects move. He says that more than a million insects are known of, but we don't know how their internal movement dynamics work at all. With this technology, we can look at the movements and could, for example, explore what technical application possibilities there would be for a particular kind of joint. In the past, scientists have used X-ray cameras to capture the motion of living insects, but some of the movements were hard to analyze without the third spatial dimension this technology provides. For example, a granary weevil is placed on top of a rotating platform and scanned by a 3D X-ray camera, which creates cross-section images of its body. Taking up to 100,000 two-dimensional pictures per second, scientists created three-dimensional sequences that show the beetle's movements in incredible detail. Van de Kamp says it's better than a 3D movie. He says that in contrast to 3D cinema, which we need special glasses to enjoy, we still only have a perspective through two eyes. But with virtual 3D, we have real 3D. This means we have the third dimension information of complete data records and can zoom into each part to look at the details of organs and therefore have the complete 3D information. Scientists say the process they call cinetomography enables them to look at tiny specimens in 3D, not from only two directions, but from 1,000 directions. For George Pudich, I'm Doug Bernard.
In just a few minutes from now, we'll hear about the violent 1815 eruption of Indonesia's Mount Tambora. So with volcanoes in mind, it's time for the Science World Quick Quiz. What is the name of the scale that was developed to provide a measure of the relative explosiveness of volcanic eruptions? Is it A, the Volcanic Explosivity Index, B, the Volcanic Seismic Scale, or C, the Volcanic Eruption Index? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
A new study shows that the human face evolved so that it could take a punch. The authors of the paper said it suggests a pugilistic past where violence was key to our evolution. Steve Barragona returns with this report.
Mike Morgan is a black belt in two martial arts.
and he is training as an emergency medicine physician at the University of Utah.
It gives me firsthand experience with a lot of the end results of human violence and aggression.
Morgan says when people fight, they go for the face. In the new study in the journal Biological Reviews, he and his co-author note changes in the shape of our faces over the course of about 4 million years of evolution.
So look at the jawbone, the portion with the lower teeth. It gets bigger. If you look back towards the hinge of the jaw joint, you can kind of see that bone getting wider.
The bone under the eye socket gets stronger, too. These are all places that take a beating in a fight. Last year, the authors published a paper detailing how, at the same time, the fist has evolved into a better fighting weapon. Morgan says only humans fight with fists. Dogs bite, cats scratch, antelopes gore, but humans punch.
When you look back in some of our closest relatives, chimpanzees, gorillas, they actually can't form a fist.
Chimps hit and slap, but a punch hurts more than a slap because it delivers force to a smaller area, Morgan says.
If you have a better weapon, if you have a stronger weapon, you can theoretically win more mates.
Which means more chances to pass on your genes, which is what evolution is all about. And as the weapon got better, the new research proposes, so did the defense.
As we develop this ability to form a fist, we see an equal development in the robustness and strength of the most commonly struck portions of the face.
All this suggests an extremely violent human evolutionary history.
At one point in time, made sense for us to be aggressive and violent. It guaranteed the survival of our species.
That may be so, but Marshall University biologist Paul Constantino has not seen evidence of it.
You know, I've studied a lot of our fossils, and we don't have a high incidence of facial trauma.
Constantino says some of the changes Morgan describes could be protection from violence, but others make more sense as adaptations to a changing diet.
I'm not against the idea that violence had some role to play in the evolution of human facial structure. I just think to try to prescribe it to everything, including the hand, including the face, is sort of stretching it.
Meanwhile, Morgan promises the fight over the competing theories will end peacefully. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Engineers have long taken cues from nature in designing new and innovative products. Roseanne Skirbel shares some lessons learned from the sticky tongues of frogs.
Thomas Kleinteich studies frog tongues. The research associate at Germany's Kiel University wanted to know how its sticking power compared to the feet of the much-studied gecko, which can blaze a trail up a wall or race upside down across a ceiling.
Basically, it was interesting to study a new adhesive system in biology.
Kleinteich designed an experiment with the horned frog, a popular pet in Germany. Placed in a terrarium behind pressure-sensitive glass, he tempted the frog with live crickets on the other side of the panel. The team then measured the forces on the glass as the frog tried to capture them.
Like the tongue impact, and also when the frog was pulling its tongue back, trying to detach again from the glass slide. Then, of course, I also got the tongue print on the glass, like after the tongue was detached.
Kleinteich and his co-workers did 80 trials using 4 frogs.
What we actually found was that their tongue adhesive forces were well beyond the body weight of these frogs. And another thing which we found, which I didn't expect, was that the mucus, or the slime on top of their tongues, doesn't seem to be that important as people always assumed.
While sticky feet can take geckos up walls, Kleinteich says in one way a frog tongue may be even more dynamic because it is blindingly fast.
In a way that frog tongues only have a few milliseconds to actually establish a contact. So it's not like having adhesive tape and to rub it against the wall and, you know, wait for a few seconds until you can load it. It's like immediately in terms of less than 10 or less than 20 milliseconds.
And since frogs have a diet that ranges from insects to small birds, their tongues can attach to many different surfaces, which Kleinteich says merits more study.
So the next steps for me will be first to study the structure of the tongues, and second also to compare multiple species to maybe find more general patterns in how this mechanism may work. Then, like in the far future, I could think of some frog-inspired adhesives, but this is way beyond where we are at the moment.
Klein Teich's study is published in the journal Scientific Reports. You can see a feeding frog and its sticky tongue in slow motion on VOAnews.com. This frog, unlike the ones in the experiment, gets the cricket. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Let's see if you've got the correct answer to our quick quiz. We asked for the name of the scale that was developed to provide a measure of the relative explosiveness of volcanic eruptions. Is it the A, Volcanic Explosivity Index, B, Volcanic Seismic Scale, or C, Volcanic Eruption Index? The answer is A. The Volcanic Explosivity Index, or VEI, was developed in 1982 by Chris Newhall of the U.S. Geological Survey and Stephen Self of the University of Hawaii. The scale currently measures the explosiveness of volcanoes on a scale of 0 to 8. If an eruption warrants a higher number, the scale can be increased. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
When famous volcanic eruptions are discussed, you normally hear about the 1983 eruption of Krakatoa, the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, Mount St. Helens' 1980 eruption in the northwest U.S., and of course, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 A.D. that annihilated the Roman city of Pompeii. But you probably haven't heard much about the eruption of Indonesia's Mount Tambora in 1815. Yet, this 19th century volcanic eruption was the most violent eruption in thousands of years. On the Volcanic Explosivity Index, or VEI, which is a standard that provides a relative measure of the explosiveness of volcanic eruptions, Mount Tambora scored a 7 out of 8 maximum. In comparison, Krakatoa and Pinatubo were both 6s, and Vesuvius and Mount St. Helens were both 5s on the VEI scale. Along with the direct destruction caused by the eruption of Mount Tambora, this volcanic calamity is said to have had a wide-ranging impact on the world. Gillen Darcy Wood from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has written Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World. It's a new book that provides a wide overview of the worldwide difficulties produced by the Mount Tambora eruption. For example, it has been noted to be a significant cause of the Year Without Summer in 1816. It has also been singled out as the cause of famines, such as Ireland's Great Famine, medical and health issues with the world's first cholera pandemic, economic turmoil with the United States' first depression, as well as the expansion of opium markets in China. The aftermath of the Mount Tambora eruption, according to Professor Wood, also helped inspire English author Mary Shelley's classic Frankenstein, and it even played a role in Napoleon Bonaparte's historical defeat at Waterloo. Professor Wood joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about the eruption of Mount Tambora and the incredible impact on humanity the explosive catastrophe left in its wake. Why do you think we haven't heard much about the Mount Tambora eruption?
Well, I think there are a couple of good reasons that we know very little about Tambora until now. It mostly has to do with communications. The destruction of Pompeii in AD 79 was memorialized by the famous Roman writer Pliny the Younger, who gave an unforgettable description of the eruption of Vesuvius. And then the other eruptions such as Krakatoa and Mount St. Helens and Pinatubo all occurred since the advent of modern communications. Tambora didn't enjoy any of those benefits and exploded on a remote island in the Dutch East Indies, as it was then, and now Indonesia, in 1815, in the age of steamships, when the news of such an event could take months to travel back to Europe or North America.
Professor, can you take us back to the spring of 1815 and the eruption of Mount Tambora?
Mount Tambora is located on an island just to the east of Bali in Indonesia. It commands an entire peninsula, and had been dormant for probably thousands of years before April of 1815, when it began to rumble and spring to life. There was a considerable eruption on April the 5th of 1815, and the inhabitants of the island of Sumbawa took fright at this first eruption, but they thought that it was possibly over with and had returned to harvesting their rice and grooming their stock of horses, for which the island was very famous. But 5 days later, on April the 10th, 1815, the largest volcanic explosion on Earth for possibly thousands of years occurred. And the entire peninsula, certainly the human population of that whole peninsula, was destroyed within hours. And darkness descended across all of Southeast Asia for a couple of days. Ash was found 3,000 kilometers away. Governments everywhere across the whole region sent out their navies thinking that they were under attack from pirates. The reverberations from the volcano were so thunderous.
Now, when Mount Tambora erupted in 1815, the world was already in what has been described as the Little Ice Age since the late 13th century. Now, how much did this Indonesian eruption further affect climate?
It had a profound effect over a 3 to 5 year period. It cooled the climate, which is the impact of a major volcanic eruption in the tropics. Its effect upon the atmosphere is to create a kind of blanket and or a shield which reflects the rays of the sun back into space. The 1810s, thanks to Tambora and another major volcano that erupted in 1809, the 1810s has a claim to be the coldest decade of the last millennium. The Little Ice Age had been kind of intermittent 6th century cold snap since the 1300s, had made life in Europe and North America quite difficult. The 1810s, of all of that entire 6th century period, the 1810s is in fact the coldest, thanks to Tambora. But this fact, this environmental or climatic fact of the deep cold, the deep freeze of the 1810s, has been little noticed by historians until now. Of course, now in the 21st century, we're much more interested in the relationship between climate and human affairs, and this has drawn our attention back toward looking at pivotal times in history, including the 1810s, and the impact that climate has on human history.
Why was 1816 considered to be the year without summer?
The first summer after a major tropical eruption will be the season most affected by climate deterioration. And this is because global cooling, instigated by a volcanic eruption, will drastically shorten the growing season available to farmers in the summer after the eruption. So you see radically shortened growing seasons all across the globe, from China to India to New England to Western Europe. Farmers have suffering under a haywire climate regime where they simply do not have enough time to grow their crops. It's too cold. Either that, or their crops are starved of rain or washed away by floods. You have a series of kind of extreme weather events that means that there's not enough food is produced. And in 1815, most of the world's inhabitants were relied upon subsistence farming. So you can imagine the consequences for communities across the globe when the usual output of food is not available in 1816. And this on top of already a number of years of poor harvests during the 1810s.
That was Gillen Darcy Wood from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of the new book, Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World, which has been published by Princeton University Press and is available from your favorite bookseller. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.